From WXXI News, I'm Frank Sigelski, and this is Connections. Again, Frank Sigelski in this hour for Evan Dawson. We're right in the middle of the growing season in upstate New York, so questions about lawn, yard, bushes, trees, planting, maintenance, etc. abound. We have our experts, Mike Tanzini and Greg Frank, here today, and they're going to take your questions, comments, concerns, tell you what you need to know about the lawn and landscape, and considering the torrential downpours we've had recently, maybe it's time to look at some other issues on your property, like, I don't know, flood control or drainage, and they can talk about that as well. I will give the number out if you want to join the show, 1-844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Gentlemen, welcome, and thanks for coming in on right in the middle of probably your busiest part of the year, maybe?
Absolutely. This is when it really is going. Everything we do now is in full spring.
Uh-huh. And that is everything that has to do with tree, lawn, landscape, and landscape architecture. What are some of the other things that you would describe? And we were talking sort of jokingly about what titles you guys have, whether you're going to be tree and landscape consultants or master landscapers, like Greg wants to be a master landscaper. But it's easy to think, well, it's just about the lawns and the trees, but there's a whole system there, a whole ecosystem, right?
Absolutely, Frank. There are certified arborists, there are consulting arborists, there are certified nursery professionals, there are landscape architects, there's landscape designers, and, Mike and I tend to do a little bit of everything, but we're landscape designers, not landscape architects. But it's a vast career, and there are many aspects of the environment, and we've done it for a while and enjoy it.
Yeah, probably not a lot that you haven't seen around this area, and the fact that we have four seasons here is probably pretty nice, because you get to deal with both deciduous vegetation and the pines and such as well. All right, so let's just kind of get right to the issue that might be on some people's minds. We've had all this flooding, and we know, obviously stay away from low-lying areas and watch out, especially at night. But for someone's yard, for the drainage issues, how would you assess someone's drainage before something like this happens? What things do you look for? What recommendations can you make? And then how do you deal with something like this? Or do you just best you can?
Well, here's the way you got to think about it. It's part building and construction and landscaping dovetail together, where your house meets the ground.
Okay.
That's a very important intersection where the vertical walls hit the horizontal plane of the land. The key and most important thing is managing the water that comes off your roof and sending it as far away from your foundation as you can. All right? And to promote that, you want to make sure you have pitch, positive pitch, meaning that it slopes away from your house. The land should slope away from your house, so to encourage water to leave the area around your basement. If it's coming back towards you or it's filling in your window wells, it's soon going to be on your floor in your basement.
Right.
And so that is roof water management and general water management is very important in terms of protecting your building. The other thing it'll affect, however, is your plant material. Plant material does not, many things do not like to have wet feet, as we call it, meaning that they live in a puddle.
Right.
And constantly get agitated by extremely damp soil, which have low oxygen in them because the water forces the air out. And that can agitate and kill plants. It can cause plants to be thin and small and brown and chronically, dying.
They're not thriving, right. And there are plants that would thrive in that environment. The weeping willows, I think, they love water.
That's the classic, right?
Right, well, but sure.
A lot of other nice plants, though, that like more moist conditions. And if you like to set up what we call a rain garden, mm-hmm. It's a basin where you can collect rainwater, grow the right kind of plants that like wet feet, but away from your house. So important to make sure the grade is such that the water flows away from your home.
Okay. So that's when you're, but if you already have a home that was already built and it's in the bottom of a little valley, you've got some issues there, and maybe you need to put a drain around the house.
Right.
Then it becomes, if you just have the slope going away from the house, it's going to solve a lot of your problems.
That's right. And we find on the older homes in the area that that area settles over time and needs to be corrected. So it's usually it's the input of topsoil to raise the grade and setting the pitch away. But however, many times there are plants planted in that zone that have to be lifted and reset at the new elevation. You can't just bury shrubs with new topsoil. It'll kill them.
Okay. Yeah. That. Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you bury them all the way, then they're underground.
Right.
Then they won't grow. I know that much, guys. Okay. So if someone's looking at their yard right now and they see an area that, gosh darn it, every time it rains, this area right, you know, near the driveway and the road that fills up with water and it's sloshy and I can't cut the grass there for a week. Should they consider maybe one of these, you know, plants that likes wet feet, as you like to say? I mean, would that take care or would that help the problem?
Well, if you have a spot that collects water for more than 12 to 24 hours and you want to grow plant material, you're going to need to get rid of that water. It areas in excess of that have standing water for 24 hours are going to hinder plant material and even eventually, you know, hinder the growth of a willow tree, as we even talked about. And that's where, you know, you can have designated areas for these low spots, these new rain gardens. You know, you can, you know, it might be easy enough just to fill that area with some topsoil, get some positive pitch, and you know, pitch it away into a lower spot. Or you might need, you know, to have a little bit more of elaborate type of system, like a French drain, or you know, something like that. That you need to collect some of this excess water, and then allow it to slowly percolate, you know, off-site someplace.
So let me understand this. You're saying that any area that has standing water for a 24-hour period, that's sort of the litmus test of you can't plant anything there, like unless you're talking about a rice paddy.
Yes. And it's eventually this excess water over time starts plants to decline. For example, we had this hellacious rain yesterday, and we have, you know, many plants were submerged in water, you know, for, you know, 12, maybe even 24 hours. You know, that little bit of time is not really going to damage the plant that much. You know, however, it's that repeated wet feet, so to say, that you're going to have issues with plant material.
You get mold and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So you can't really use a plant to sop up standing water. I'm looking for an eat. All right, we've got a standing water in our yard, all right, and I want to fix it.
Right. Well, willow trees have a reputation for sopping up water. Now, I don't agree with that. They use water. They translocate water. It goes to their roots, comes out the leaves. As a water vapor, there's a positive pressure there. However, they're not going to mop your lawn for you, okay? They will exist there because they can tolerate dampness, but they don't change the situation. Bad drainage is bad drainage.
Right.
The function of the land contours, or some effect of damming it downstream, all right? So with water, you need to release water to daylight, right? If it's trapped, you got to move it to the next lowest spot. And, of course, you got to think about your neighbors. You can't just dump water on your neighbors regarding the town's codes and so on,
right,
or onto the right-of-way and create a hazard with moving your water. So if you have a water movement challenge, you got to have either – let's say a natural creek that can take it, or a drainage swale that's established in the engineering of your neighborhood, or you got to consult with your town because you can't just extend water pipes wherever you want. You got to do them in compliance with code and town regulations and rules.
Okay, and you know, all towns and such, they're going to be a little bit different. How do I know when it's gotten to the point where I might want to consult the town? Because most folks, they think if I consult the town, the next thing you know, I'm going to have to pay for some kind of permit, and then they're going to inspect it, and then they're going to, you know, I mean,
yeah.
And I don't mean to malign, you know, the folks who do that, because it's important to have people to keep an eye on that type of thing. But at what point does it become, you know, where going to the town might even help? Because I've heard people have actually gotten grants or pointed in the direction of where they can get money to help solve a serious drainage problem.
Right. Yeah. You just don't want to do any harm with your water.
Okay.
That moves off your site to the next place it's going to go. All right. So if you can evaluate that circumstance that you're not creating a water problem for your neighbor, or putting water where it could turn into ice and create a hazard, or, you know, those kind of things.
Right, right.
So you have to be aware of what the water does downstream when you're moving it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
If you can contain it on your own property, great.
Right.
You know, you take it from your downspouts to your rain garden, let your rain garden absorb it and let it soak into your own land, you're doing nobody any harm because you're containing it.
Right.
So, and if your downspouts are tapped into the storm drains, that's a source to take water to put it in a legal system.
Right, so, right, right.
So it's all a matter of – that's why, you know, the town, although they have rules, mm-hmm. they can be very helpful. If mm-hmm. you have a water problem, that's worthy of evaluating that way.
Right, right. Okay, Mike Tanzini and Greg Frank are here for this hour of Connections. They are experts from Ted Collins Tree and Landscape. And if you'd like to talk to them or if you have a question, the number is 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. Okay, July is turning into August. What do you need to be concerned about now? Are we looking forward to the fall season where we need to get ready for that, or harvest, or are there things we should? What type of fertilizer should we be using if we're using it?
Well, I'll tell you, Frank, with the weather that we've had, normally right now we're looking at burnt, spent lawns and droopy plants. You know, we had a little bit of a dry spell. We had a wet spring, a little bit of a dry spell, and then now the last 3 or 4 weeks, these on and off rains that have really perked things back up again. So, you know, what in the very near future will be pruning issues to take care of. Weeds, you know, once you get some rain, weeds. So for example, I was at the farmer's market on Saturday, and I was surprised to see how late some of the fruit is. For example, peaches, normally are in abundance right now, and though they are at the market, they're certainly not set and not ready yet. Tomatoes are a little bit behind. The last time we were on, we talked about, we're basically, 3 to 4 weeks behind in the plant calendar. You know, that quickly changed, but, it doesn't really change that quickly. The apple growers are a little bit behind, though the fruit should be exquisite. And, we're still into the July and August with a lot of moisture. So it's almost like June. So we're going to get another heavy, heavy spurt of growth. And so I think we're going to be more in a maintenance mode here for the next 2 to 3 weeks. And then start thinking about fall. But we don't want to think about fall at least until September time.
Okay, fantastic. All right, why don't we go to the phones? We have Linda in West Henrietta. Linda, welcome to Connections. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm calling. I was in a relatively new development, and, of course, it didn't come with topsoil. So we put a lot of topsoil on the property, except in this one area, where we put in a Concord fir about 3 years ago. And last summer, we had a relatively wet summer, and it struggled. And it was. We also had a sandy area where it was. So we went to one of the nurseries and talked to them, and they suggested putting some topsoil or some soil down and some Osmocote, I think that's what it's called, which we did, and it died over the winter. And so I'm wondering what you could suggest, because it's a really sandy area, maybe either putting more topsoil down or a type of tree that would thrive in that area.
All righty. When you have a circumstance like that, where you have a lean soil, you need to enhance it with compost. If you're going to plant another tree, you got to dig in a lot of compost into the soil around that planting site. That's not just the immediate hole, but well beyond that, because you want the roots to move from the initial planting hole out into the native land. All right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And so with choosing, if you want an evergreen, if you want a tree that is tough, fast-growing, hardy, I would pick a Norway spruce.
And what kind of spruce?
Norway spruce.
Oh, Norway. Okay.
Yeah. It's It's going to give you a tree faster. It's sturdy, durable, doesn't have a lot of problems. You'll get some satisfaction from that. Plant it in a rich soil environment that you improve, and make sure you mulch it out beyond its branch spread, and don't let the grass grow up under it so it has its own bed to grow in. And then make sure you water that plant minimally once a week, especially during the summer, to make sure it has adequate moisture throughout the whole growing season from its initial planting till you have to put the hoses away in the fall.
What about fertilizer?
Fertilizer, initially you only want to use an organic fertilizer like Holytone, which is non-burning. It's not going to injure your tree or plant, but it'll provide nutrients over a period of time.
Okay.
All right. And after the tree is established, meaning it's growing in that spot for 2 years, you can then start supplementing the fertilization with fertilizer scratched in or applied to your mulch area underneath the out beyond the branch edges.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Well, good luck to you on your new tree.
Okay. Thank you.
Fantastic. You know, it's interesting because, you know, good luck on the new tree. People plant trees to commemorate things, I sort of forgot about that. But there was a tree that was planted in Los Angeles to memorialize, I think, George Harrison, one of the Beatles, and it just died because it wasn't getting enough water because of the drought, and then some insects came along, and now it's gone. But I know there might be listeners who are thinking, "Oh, a tree is a tree," and trees are valuable; they're expensive. They're huge. They're a big part of the environment, and they can be really significant and special to people. Like, you know, on a golf course, this tree is planted in the memory of so-and-so. So this is, you know, again, emphasizing the importance of the work that you guys do. The other thing that I was thinking about as she was speaking about the topsoils, would it be possible to put, like, different, like, maybe four different topsoils, you know, discreetly on a lawn so that you could plant different things and get more variety out of what you're planting?
Well, it topsoil is a interesting word. Just because what is in fact topsoil? Now, what happens to be lately is the top layer of soil, and that soil could be clayey, it could be non-organic, it could be gravelly. It's anything but what we think is topsoil. So that's why we like to talk about compost and, you know, utilizing the soil that we have on our yard, but fortifying it with a compost material. A compost bin where you have your vegetables and grasses
and
the area. Municipalities have leaf mold, and many of them mulch their own trees and things up. So there's a lot of stuff that's out there that you can put into your soil to make it more organic. And one of the best ways to know what you really are dealing with is to take a simple soil test. Our area cooperative extension, for a nominal fee, you know, $10-$15, you take them the soil, and they'll give you an idea of what really you're dealing with, what the pH is, you know, how much sand, clay, silt, and those combinations. But moreover, it's organic, it's organics, or it's natural fertility. And then you can sort of homogenize these areas with different types of compost instead of different types of soil to address certain types of plants, broadleaf evergreens like a more sour soil. It's some of our lilacs like a more sweeter soil. So it, then you can sort of manipulate your areas by adding compost instead of by adding, you know, quote unquote topsoil.
Well, that's a wonderful answer to a very, you know, I would say a naive question now that I look at that, because what you explain makes so much sense. Now, when you talk about sweet or sour, you're talking about acid or base type?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Soil pH.
pH, mm-hmm. Okay. So how much soil do they need? Do I just take a shovel full from the middle of my yard, put it in a bucket, and take it to the cooperative extension? Or
a baggie. Half a baggie.
Half a baggie.
Yep, is enough. But you want a random sample. Let's say you're doing the lawn, you want to know about the lawn, you random sample it.
Right, that's going to...
If you're doing a garden, it's 100 by... 20, you know, 200. You got to go around and sample randomly.
Right, okay? So you get
an average blend of your soil.
Right, because you could just, you know, shovel out, and you just happen to shovel where at one point there was a bird feeder there, and then they had to put sand there or whatever, and you don't know.
Well, yeah, you never know.
You never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's that. Now, is that something that you typically do when you're consulting with someone who's having, you know, big picture problems with their lawn and such? I mean, do you do that? It sounds like that's part of your science.
Yeah, it's a baseline. You know, it's a good starting point instead of guessing. You can read soil pH by plants that are indicators.
Ah.
So if rhododendrons are very happy at the site, that's a good indication that the pH might be slightly acid.
Huh.
Whereas if the rhododendrons are all yellow and sticky or, you know, they've had no success growing them, that's a pretty good sign that the soil may be alkaline.
Yeah,
or bad draining, you know, lack organics, which is all the things rhododendrons would like. So there are these indicator plants out there that give us clues as to what's going on there. You can kind of read the landscape in terms of what plants are successful and what plants are ill, and, you know, you got sort of an idea of what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, and going back to my simple example of the weeping willow tree, who hasn't been driving along 5 and 20 or whatever, and you look down and you see, you know, a lower lying area, and is there a creek there? Ah, and you see a row of willows that are just going in a straight line
they're
following the creek and,
yeah.
and reading the landscape like that. And again, it's just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Are there any, are there any concerns this year regarding insects, disease? I know in the past we've talked about the emerald ash borer. Is there anything that maybe our listeners have missed that they should be aware of?
Well, I tell you, it's with our weather, it has been, you know, naturally a hindrance to, you know, a lot of our disease and insect problems. You know, you have these plants, flowering crab apples, that are going to get a leaf blight, but now there are many varieties that are available that don't get apple scab. So it, on you know, insect populations, we've found it to be a below normal occurrence, both with disease and insects. Obviously, there's still the threat, and not even the threat, there's still the issue with the emerald ash borer. There was an ash rust also that was a problem that some people thought was emerald ash borer. But all in all, it's been, you know, it's been good. One of the callers said, boy, we had a wet, you know, summer last year. Yes, we did, which is good for plant material. We had a wet spring this year. So, you know, moisture, you know, plants like it, and they'll thrive in it. What we saw last year, and I think what we're going to see this year, is these plants exploding, where they have just so much weight because all of the new growth that they're going to need to be, pruned and lightened up just to, just to allow some of our natural windstorms and all that to go through without doing a lot of damage. But, we sort of track what happens on a yearly basis. In the last couple of years, we have noticed that we're finding, you know, more damage to plant material, you know, from winds and storms. So it, it's this abundance of water and a lot of growth, and, we're going to have to adjust our pruning and planting cycle.
And again, you have greater challenges here because of all those reasons, the changing seasons, the wind and such. You have to factor that all in especially when you're doing something from scratch. And I guess I'll just ask, do you do a lot of work from scratch? In other words, here's a development, you've got a blank palette, Mike, Greg, figure out what might work here.
Mm-hmm. We do some of that. We do a lot of retro work where we're restoring yards. We'll be saving some good trees and plants. We'll be taking out bad trees and bad plants. We'll be fitting around additions and modifications and swimming pools. And most of the projects we work on, we are saving plants, taking out plants, integrating new plants. We do occasionally get that clean slate where there's not a thing there.
Mm-hmm.
In the real estate environment, the new build has slowed down some
right
over the heydays of the 80s when Right. There was many, many brand-new neighborhoods starting from scratch all over the place, where every tree came in was imported, you know, and added to, unless there were some woods there or a creek bed or something that had some natural foliage. But the trend lately is there's a little less of that kind of cornfield building going on,
yeah,
where
sure.
they start with raw land. And it's actually – it's more of a challenge to work around existing things, because you got to decide whether a tree's worthy of staying. Is mm-hmm. it going to be a good part of this landscape long term? How does it, you know, has it sustained any damage while during construction, if there's some of that? You know, what plants have killed other plants? Because the landscape is very dynamic, ever changing. Every year is a different, the place becomes a different place every growing season.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, we have to unsnarl all that and sort of restart the whole process. And some of the best projects are those kind of projects where you have mature plants combined with new plants.
Sure, that sounds...
And it really makes for, you know, a well-balanced property, as opposed to the trees being tiny relative to the house and the neighborhood and all that. Looks so out of scale.
Yes,
yeah. Because the trees take the longest to display and perform.
Right.
They take lifetimes, whereas shrubs take, you know, half a decade, 5 years. A shrub display is clicking.
Right.
But a tree, you know, in 5 years might only... double its size from being, you know, 10 feet to 20.
Right, right.
Maybe.
Yeah, there are some, like, trees. We had one in our backyard that I'm told is a, quote, junk tree, but it grew, I mean, 30 feet in just a few years. I mean, it, yeah, really soft wood.
Yeah, cottonwood or
something like that. Yeah,
box elder or something like that.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, there
okay.
are some trees that'll do that. But, yeah, when you're planting landscapes, the trees you're really planting for others.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. All right, Mike Tanzini and Greg Frank are here for this hour of Connections, and we'd love to hear from you if you have any questions on lawns, landscapes, and such. The number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I'm Frank Sigelski, sitting in today for Evan Dawson, and we'll be back in a minute on WXXI, WEOS, the WXXI mobile app, and WXXINews.org.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Genesee Country Village, hosting the Laura Ingalls Wilder Weekend with actress Melissa Sue Anderson, who portrayed Mary Ingalls on Little House on the Prairie, and featuring children's activities Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 4. GCV.org.
Wednesday on Connections, Michelle Faust will ask the question, how do we raise healthy children? We'll discuss the risk of childhood obesity, healthy eating and exercise, and how to keep their minds healthy as well. In the second hour, we'll get a preview of the Puerto Rican festival and parade coming this weekend and discuss how Latinos are portrayed in the media. It's all coming up Wednesday on Connections. And continuing on Connections, I'm Frank Sigelski in for Evan Dawson today. Mike Tanzini and Greg Frank from Ted Collins Tree and Landscaper here. Join the show at 844-295-TALK, 295-8255. All right, so we've got this lush landscape out there, and trees are blooming, and shrubs are shrubbing, and so on and so forth. That means that something is right down the road in order to keep those plants healthy, and that is pruning. The P word.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to know? What are the common mistakes people make when they start trimming away? And when do we start? And just give us the thumbnail sketch of what we need to know about pruning.
All right. Go ahead, Greg.
No, I was just going to say, and I'll let you take it from there.
All right.
We have so many people that are afraid to prune.
Huh.
And when you said that, these mistakes that you make now, rarely are you going to make a dramatic mistake on a plant that you're going to kill it. And, our best gardeners are ones that do their own experimenting. And, there are certain things of timing that obviously we'll talk about. But the thing of it is get in there and do some of it. Mm-hmm. If you prune the deadwood out, the crossing branches, you've almost you know, prune the plant already, and you really don't need to do anything, but maybe you shape the crown. But, Mike, I'll let you.
Right. You know, fear is the number one problem, and having junk tools is the other thing.
Okay.
All right? So people should invest, in, if nothing else, in one good pair of hand pruners that cut efficiently and are sharp and stay sharp and are repairable and sharpenable. Okay? So buy yourself a good pair of pruners, a good little hand saw. You know, and with those two items, you can do an awful lot of nice pruning in your yard. As you get more skill and ability and aggressive, you need more aggressive tools, on up to a chainsaw if you were inclined. All right? But, you know, I mean, that's kind of where it goes.
Yeah, and start with a trunk, and the job's done real soon.
Right. That's the one pruning cut.
The one pruning cut, that would be a mistake, right?
Right. Yep. But, you know, in plant pruning, what I like, people always say, well, when should I prune that? I say, follow the bloom.
Follow the bloom. Okay.
Right? So let's say you have a lilac, right, in your yard.
Sure.
If you start pruning on them now, you're not going to have many flowers next spring because they're already making flower buds for next year. They carry them over on the tree in the winter.
Okay.
So if you prune it in the winter, you cut off flowers. But a lilac blooms in May. If you prune it first of June, when those flowers fade, following the bloom.
Following. It's a time thing, temporal thing.
Right.
Not like a crown or a grow line. It's, you know, May, the flowers are blooming, then they die off, prune right away,
right? So that's the key on flowering shrubs and flowering trees. If you don't want to interrupt the flowering cycle, and that's why you're growing them, is you follow the bloom. So just always put that little thing in your mind. And they always look the worst when the flowers are done. So what happens is you prune, you get a new growth response, your plant starts to get pretty again.
Mm-hmm.
It may bloom and it may not bloom depending on the kind of plant it is.
It'll green up a bit.
But it'll green up. It'll hold the shape that you give it. So that's always a good idea, is to follow the bloom.
Okay, so that's one good tip. And we'll get to some other ones, but first let's go back to the phones. We have Ann in Greece. Ann, welcome to Connections. Ann, you're on the air.
Hi. So I made a mistake planting a tree, and I'm wondering if I can move it.
Do you know what type of plant it is? What type of tree?
It's a peewee hydrangea.
Mm-hmm.
And the circumference, I just went out and measured the circumference of the trunk. It's about 9 inches.
Yes, you can transplant those, but I would wait now to when the plant is dormant, whether it be in the fall time or the springtime. And what a good rule of thumb is to start digging your trench. If you've got a diameter, let's take, I don't have a calculator, so
three
I can't
inches.
Take 3 inches.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Just divide by three. Close
so
enough.
So you want to dig a trench around this plant that's 30 inches wide. And you want to go down about 12 inches. So it's 10 inches per each inch in caliper. And then just start to comb back towards the trunk until you get to pencil-sized roots. Then undercut it, so you've got this almost like pancake of soil, and then you're able to move it. Now, I would wait for spring, just because personally I like to have the hydrangea sort of go through its cycle without any stress. And even though the plant is dormant, you're still going to stress it a little bit. So I would wait till springtime to transplant that. But they're very, very good transplanters, even the PG hydrangea.
Oh. Okay, so you said 10 inches per inch of caliper?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I thought maybe I would have to hire somebody with a piece of equipment, but it sounds like I can do it by hand.
You could.
Yeah,
you
if you're careful.
Yeah.
And if I can ask, what was the mistake? You said you made a mistake in planting it, and if it's personal,
No, it's I planted it for privacy, but it's too close to the house, and it's overhanging a sidewalk, and so people have to walk around the sidewalk, you know, around the tree to get to the sidewalk, and it just needs to be moved to a larger space because it's growing quickly.
Yeah, do it before any leaves appear in the spring. So late March, early April, get it done and over with. And by the way, you can cut that top in quite a bit. They're very tolerant of pruning.
Really?
Yeah, and they bloom now, so you can cut those in early spring, shape the top, and reset the size of the top in conjunction with your move. And you might want to stake it up, too, make sure it doesn't wobble when you first plant it, okay?
Yes, thank you so much for your help.
Okay.
All right, good luck. Yeah, I mean, that's the type of thing that that happens all the time. Mm-hmm. How big, I mean, how big is a tree? What's the biggest tree that a person like our last caller can move? At what point do you need to call in the heavy equipment?
I'd say right about where she is right now, a 3-inch caliper plant. You know, it's a PG hydrangea tends to be more shrub-like. If it was a 3-inch caliper maple tree, it would probably be best to call in a professional to take care of that. But, you know, it's hydrangea is a good transplant. You can beat them up a little bit, and they're still gonna survive and be okay.
Well, she chose the right plant to misplant them. Good. All right. Again, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Mike Tanzini and Greg Frank are here for this hour of Connections. Anything else we wanted to follow up on pruning? And then I had a question about the painting the scar where you prune. And I understand that that's not really done anymore.
That's right. Plants have the ability to close wounds.
Like a
themselves.
Scab.
Right. And they compartmentalize their wounds. They don't heal like we do. They grow another annual ring, and that ring adds more bark and wood, and it eventually will compartmentalize the wound and put the wound behind living tissue, which protects the tree from invaders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And there's also chemical things that change when branches are cut that help to wall off invaders.
Mm-hmm.
It's a change in the chemistry of the wood. All right? So a very interesting science if you ever want to read about it. But one of the conclusions in that whole study they did, U.S. Forest Service did this, was that trees don't need any help or Band-Aids. It only makes us feel better, and
okay.
It gets black stuff on our clothes. That was the long and the short of it. They painted tree wounds for years, but it really was doing nothing.
It maybe harming the tree?
No harm, but no help.
Yeah.
So it was a process that was eliminated because of a messy, time-consuming process. Imagine pruning a big oak tree and having to go paint every wound that's over the size of a nickel.
Right. And if you didn't do it, the common knowledge was that you were being negligent.
Customer would say, get back up in that tree and paint those wounds.
Right. And you would say, well, there's this study, and the early results show that we really don't need to do that, and it's less expensive if we don't do that.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, so that worked out. So that's the long and short of that. On pruning, more to say, there's only two kinds of pruning cuts you can make on a plant.
Okay.
You are either doing a thinning cut where you're removing a branch from its origin. So imagine a branch comes into the side of another branch. You take it off there. That's called a thinning cut.
Okay.
Back to the parent stem where it arose. The other kind of cut you can make is a shortening cut where you're cutting back from the end. So you're counting down and in, and you cut it at another bud or branch. That's considered a shortening cut. So there's really only two kinds of cuts you make. So to demystify pruning,
okay.
You're either shortening branches or you're taking them out, thinning them out.
Right.
And there's really no other kind of cut you can make. Now, doing a privet hedge, those are all shortening cuts because
right.
You're shortening branches.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you go into your maple tree and you open the canopy up so there's more air inside, that's thinning cuts.
Sure.
You're not cutting the ends back in. In many cases, it's one or the other or some combination of shortening cuts and thinning cuts that go together to give you the aesthetic you want.
Right, right.
And one thing about pruning is beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some rules about how far you can push plants back chronically, you know, every year, cutting them to the same point, which is not good for them because they don't grow. They can't be robust.
Right.
So
they need – yeah, I should just – yeah, it's like – like a haircut. You don't want to take off too much at one time, and you don't want to keep doing it year after year.
Right.
Well, maybe it's not like a haircut.
Yeah, so it's a little different. But
it's very different. Sorry.
In terms of pruning style, there's the natural style, the form the plant would naturally have if it grew untouched,
mm-hmm.
except to take out the bad wood and maybe balance it. So that's natural style pruning where you're encouraging the natural look of the plant. Then there's these architectural styles, force styles, topiaries, and so on, where you're forcing the plants into shapes, boxes, triangles,
right.
Pyramids,
Disney
birds,
characters at Disney
elephant,
World.
Right? Yeah. Whatever you want to do, it's all in your imagination if you follow a few basic rules.
And it can be done. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We have Tom in Brighton. Tom, welcome to Connections.
Thank you for taking my call. Problem with tomato plants. They were very, very healthy, food set up, and we went away for 10 days, and now they got blossom end rot. What do I do about that?
Well, are they Are they still robust a little, or?
Oh yeah, they're still very healthy, and they're setting new fruit.
Okay.
Then it's just that the ones that as they ripen, they develop a rot.
Yes. Well, what you need to do is get them back on a turgid water schedule. So what happens is while you were gone, the watering cycle sort of was interrupted. And once that happens, the tomato gets very fussy, especially when it's trying to, you know, produce its fruit and set its fruit. So the only thing to do one of the things to do right now than starting over is cultivate your soil. Any leaves that have dropped, get rid of. Make sure underneath the plant is nice and clean. You cultivate that, you're going to give it a little bit of air. And then I would make sure that you don't let it go through a water deficit again. There's a better chance than you think that you're going to resurrect that plant again, especially with some of the fruit that didn't get the rot and some of the new fruit that you have. But it occurs when there is a water deficit. And unfortunately, it's just at the time that you you went on your vacation. So, but get after it, air it up, and start watering, and they will recover.
Would fertilizer help at all?
Well, a lot of times what you're going to do is push green growth instead of flower buds. And right now the plant is growing. It is setting buds, as you said, setting fruit, and you have some of the fruit on there. I wouldn't really recommend to give it any fertilizer, because you really want to concentrate on not green growth, but fruit.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's very good. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, is that because tomatoes are a little bit more sensitive of a plant terms of the water cycle? You talked about this plant didn't get water. Many plants, even in our area, can go, for a couple of weeks without water, and it doesn't have to be on a regular cycle. Is that unique to a sensitive plant like a tomato, or is a tomato not sensitive?
Well, it's basically the fruit. For example, a apple tree, if you go through a deficit, it's going to hinder or damage some of the fruit. You know, vegetables tend to be a little shorter lived, a little, more herbaceous than fruit trees. But, for my peppers, if I miss, a watering cycle on them, I'm certainly going to have issues with them too. So as they're setting flower and as they're setting fruit, that's the time to be concentrating that they don't go through a drought or a water deficit.
And as part of that, are you talking about a regular, consistent amount of water, or is it just lack of water? Is the problem the consistency? Like if a plant is used to getting water every third day, what it needs, and then all of a sudden it doesn't get watered for 5 days, and then it's 8 days, and is it the lack of water or the lack of, like, the timing of the water, I guess is what I'm asking?
Well, it's a little bit of both, but it's you don't want the plant to go into drought, so you don't want it to wilt, and it's more that, they'll take a little bit of differences in water schedule. It not every 3 days, but I'll tell you, if you've been watering every 3 days and they're in that flower and fruit stage, and then you go, let's say, 7 or 8, 9 days, and we're 80, 90 degree days with humidity, that's when they'll, the fruit, and it's not that the fruit is dies. It gets a disease because it just isn't strong enough to hoard it off.
Sure, I would imagine plants, just like humans, when there's a deficit of something, the body or the plant is going to protect its vital organs, if you will, and maybe the fruit is the last thing to get taken care of, mm-hmm. Because it can refruit, something like that. Do you guys do anything with vegetables, vegetable gardens?
you
personally. I mean, you know, we coach people on it who want to get who are interested. Usually, starting with the basics. What do? I want a garden, you know, or we integrate a garden into a design, so there's a dedicated plot that's aesthetically pleasing that can be part of the home garden. Because people are really intrigued with herbs these days.
Mm-hmm.
They love herbs, fresh vegetables. It's really back on the table as far as home gardening goes and using your land and as a resource and growing local, buying local, you know, eating closer to home.
Right, right, right.
So that's why, you know, gardens are very much in fashion.
Yeah, okay, so you know enough about them to put them into a plan and get folks started.
Yeah.
And that's I was going to say, it seems like that is a trend,
mm-hmm.
Local vores or whatever they're called. And an herb garden can be, I imagine, in a window box type setting.
Yeah, it doesn't need many square feet. It can be container, window box, part of your landscaping. Parts of your landscaping definitely can be edible.
Yeah, sure.
Blueberries are very popular again. Now, that's a good shrub. It's got beautiful fall color. It flowers. It makes fruit that you can eat. Just needs a little soil prep. Likes the acid soil, like the rhododendrons. Needs plenty of sunshine. Needs good drainage. But the nurseries are all carrying blueberries as shrubs again because they're popular.
Right, and you can eat the fruit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, are there plants that might repel mosquitoes? How's that for a question? Like a citronella plant. How about that? No. You know what I mean? Because that's another concern that many people have. I, you know, don't like mosquitoes. And so is there a – or is that just thought?
Well, it best for mosquitoes is to have less plant material and more dryness, more air.
Yeah.
You know, they like to – any, you know, setting water like it – after you said that, Frank, I was thinking after – the rain that we had, the mosquito population, it spikes so quickly. So
yeah.
But mosquitoes, you know, don't like, you know, windy, dry areas. They like, you know, areas under trees, damp, moist, and that's where, you know, that's where you're gonna find them. But there's citronella candles and things like that that sort of keeps them away a little bit. But
back to the pruning.
Yes,
if you keep your property neat. Right? You know, and your foliage under control, yeah, and your lawn mowed and so on, you have get rid of the weeds, that's just less cover for them, and good air circulation. Right? Empty anything that's got water sitting in it.
Absolutely.
Or
tires.
Clean it daily, like a bird bath or whatever, you know. Make sure you dump it and clean it because the larva will quickly, you know, be swimming around in there.
Absolutely, and that's one thing that we always do because it's amazing what collects water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little trowel. Someone left their shoes out and they got water in them. I don't know why the water doesn't drain through the sneaker, but, you know, yeah. And it doesn't take long for mosquitoes to breed.
Yeah.
And I actually have this habit. I told you about the standing water on our property. It's along the driveway, you know, because the driveway impedes the flow of the water. And whenever there's water there, I'm backing out of the driveway, I go through the puddle to disturb any thing that might be breeding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just part of, you know, keeping your home well, and it relates. There seems to be a new trend in mosquito control companies popping up. I've heard ads, you know, from people who, like, will put you on a maintenance program for mosquito control. You know, they're out there, just like lawn care.
Yeah, but that's not going to – I mean, that's going to be maybe they're spraying some sort of fog or –
I think they even give you a guarantee for X number of days. It might be, but I've heard ads. That's
okay, I've heard ads. That's all I'm going to say.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
Well, it's you know, that mosquitoes and the Lyme disease and ticks and we've started a tick program just because of the abundance of deer and you know, the population of this little mouse that really took care of a lot of the ticks. You know, is declining. So in areas where there's a lot of deer, people are concerned. So, you know, there's treatments that can be put around the perimeter of the plant that, you know, slow some of this tick movement down. And, you know, so that's because we love deer and you love Bambi, they also bring, you know, some pests around that aren't necessarily the best to have around.
Right, right. I know that if you have mosquitoes, maybe putting a bat, like bats, you know, bats that fly around and eat mosquitoes, you can actually
install things that will attract bats, and then they fly around and eat the mosquitoes. But a lot of people don't like the idea of bats flying around their house. I think they'd rather have the mosquitoes, to tell you
the
truth.
They may not do it, but it's going on all night out there.
Yeah,
If you could see them. You know,
I just remember that movie. Ace Ventura, wasn't that a...
Oh, yeah. Bat Detective? Oh, yeah. That was in the second one, I think.
Yeah, the bat thing.
He went in, yeah, he was... That was... Greg, that was a movie. That was fiction.
Right.
But a very good fiction at that. That's it. So, okay, so there's that. What about the burlap bags that people wrap their shrubs in? I know it's too soon for that. Is that just to protect them? Is it necessary? If you have to do that, are you trying to grow something that shouldn't be growing in this area?
Well, yes. From a designer's point of view,
mm-hmm.
if you're putting plants in jeopardy from road salt, constant wind, that aren't up to the struggle,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you got a plant out of place.
Mm-hmm.
However, as designers, sometimes we have to make decisions on plants and interface with the environment that causes us to need to put up a barrier, add barriers, add protection. People invest in plant material. They want blockage from the road. They don't want them to die from salt spray or wind or whatever, and you got to erect barriers. And unfortunately, they look trashy, but in our climate – and under the conditions we live in with road salt and so on, sometimes you have to do it.
And you're just talking about the burlap bags, or are you talking about some other type of protection?
Well, it's usually burlap allows air to move through but traps particles.
Mm-hmm.
Plastic wrapped around a plant is not a good thing.
It's
like putting it in a greenhouse in the winter, and it gets warm during the day, and it's very cold at night. Warm, cold, warm. That's bad.
Yeah.
So burlap is the preferred material as opposed to... solid stuff.
Anything else?
Yeah. So ideally, if you get your landscape organized right, you wouldn't have to erect barriers.
Right, right. Or, but if you start to push the limit, for example, I know some folks who they want to grow some figs here. And to grow a fig tree here, they really need to be protected because they're not indigenous.
Right.
So you have that as
you
well.
You got to bury them.
All right.
Or have to have a semi-heated space.
Or a greenhouse, something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you for coming in today. Mike Tanzini and Greg Frank from Ted Collins Tree and Landscape. Thanks, gentlemen.
It was a lot of fun.
All righty. So we got to grow now, I guess is what we say. On behalf of Roger Nelson, our board operator today, I'm Frank Sigelski sitting in for Evan Dawson, and you have been listening to Connections on WXXI AM, WEOS, the WXXI mobile app, and WXXINews.org.